This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن رب ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Day 7 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Moscow pushing ahead with a military operation while facing fierce resistance from Ukrainian forces. President Biden bans Russian flights from U.S. skies following similar moves by the European Union and Canada. Also ahead, the Brent crude tops $110 a barrel, while Asian stocks fall over fears of the impact of sanctions on Moscow. Those were the top stories. Our top story, Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its seventh day, with major cities, including the capital, Kyiv, being the target of attacks. An airstrike on Kyiv's main television tower has killed five people and knocked out some state broadcasting. Satellite images show Russian tanks and armored vehicles moving toward the city, with the convoy stretching for more than 65 kilometers. Also in the northeastern city of Kharkiv, clashes have erupted after Russian airborne troops landed. Earlier, a shelling attack on the city's central square claimed the lives of 10 people. Eight others were also killed in an airstrike on a housing block. Meanwhile, the Russian army has set up checkpoints at entry points in the Black Sea city of Kherson. Russia's defense minister has vowed to push ahead with the operation until its objectives are met. Hours ago, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered his first State of the Union address to Congress. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine was the primary theme of his speech, during which he pledged that the West will be all united in the face of the Russian attack on Ukraine.
He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united.
Biden had some tough words for President Vladimir Putin, accusing him of launching a premeditated and unprovoked war on Ukraine. He called Putin a dictator and said he'll pay a continuing high price over the long run. Biden said Washington, with the help of its allies, is inflicting economic pain on Russia, and he even announced a ban on Russian flights.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
Biden also said, and these are his actual words, that Washington is choking off Russia's access to technology that'll sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. The U.S. president blamed his Russian counterpart for the anti-Moscow sanctions and claimed that Putin has never been so isolated. Biden said the conflict with Ukraine will leave Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. Tell us more actually about that State of the Union address. I'm joined by our man, Mr. Colin Campbell, Dr. Colin Campbell, to be correct, who joins us out of Washington, D.C. Dr. Campbell, please come in and tell us your understanding and how Mr. Biden's speech, State of the Union speech, reverberated in America where you are.
Well, so far it has been received quite well because of the fact that he talked about so many different things. Of course, the speech had to be rewritten because of the developing events that have happened over the past week. Now, the president did have to address the situation going on in Ukraine and talk about America's values. That's what he did there. But he also had a very tall order in addressing what was happening domestically. And of course, we're still faced with COVID-19 restrictions here. We still have an economy that's being affected by that. At the same time, we're facing inflation, and the president had to show that he empathized with the American people at the same time that the union was strong, which is how he characterized it. So the president had a number of issues that he had to discuss tonight, and I think that for many Americans, especially if you're a Democrat or left-leaning, as they say, this speech resonated well with them. He talked about a lot of things, a very aggressive domestic agenda, improving the economy, refurbishing America's infrastructure, battling the opioid epidemic, improving policing, trying to lower drug costs, improving Medicare and Medicaid. All of these things are issues that resonate with Americans. The question is, though, will he get everything done?
All right. Many, many thanks for that update. That's Dr. Colin Campbell, our man in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much, and have a good time. Western countries are piling up pressure on Russia as Moscow pushes ahead with its military operation in Ukraine. The West has sought to cripple Russia's banking sector with a barrage of sanctions. In one of the latest measures, the European Union banned selected Russian banks from the SWIFT global payment system. The sanctions have led Russian national currency to hit record lows against the dollar. In response, the Russian government has ordered emergency capital controls, including a ban on cash exports of foreign currency exceeding $10,000 in value. The EU has also banned Russian state media outlets RT and Sputnik from broadcasting in the bloc. The European Council says the sanctions against Moscow have been massive and unprecedented.
We have responded with massive and unprecedented sanctions. We imposed sanctions on political and military leaders, on oligarchs, on Vladimir Putin, on Sergei Lavrov. We are also taking powerful measures to severely restrict the use of the foreign currency reserve of the Russian Central Bank. We are excluding key Russian banks from the SWIFT system. And we are also imposing severe sanctions on key sectors of Russia's economy.
The West's sanctions have also targeted Russia's energy sector. Britain and Canada have barred Russia-linked vessels from entering their ports, I should be saying. The UK has also warned that removing Russia as one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council is among the options on the table. More than a dozen European countries, as well as Canada, have also closed their airspace to Russia. In retaliation, Russia has shut off all the 27 EU nations, as well as Britain and Canada, from its airspace. The U.S. has also expelled a dozen Russian diplomats in the country's UN mission. Russia has vowed to retaliate, saying it will not yield to sanctions and pressures. This comes as the UN's International Court of Justice says it'll hold public hearings early next week over a lawsuit filed by Ukraine seeking a halt to Moscow's offensive. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank say they are racing to provide billions of dollars of additional funding to Ukraine in the coming weeks. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is rattling global markets, with oil prices surging to seven-year highs amid supply disruption fears over the economic sanctions on Moscow. Brent crude oil has surged past $110 per barrel. Also, U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude is up by 5% at above $108. OPEC and other major producers, including Russia, will hold a meeting to discuss increasing output to control price rises. On Tuesday, the International Energy Agency, which includes the United States, agreed to release 60 million barrels of crude reserves to try and curb the soaring prices, but a disruption from Russia, one of the world's top oil producers, could send prices even higher. Also, Asian stocks declined as investors fretted about the impact of sanctions on Russia. Observers are concerned that the disruption caused by the sanctions could have a deep negative impact on global growth and inflation. All right, let's discuss this a little bit further with Mr. Steve Keen. He's an economist and author, author of The New Economics, A Manifesto, who joins us via Skype out of the Thai capital of Bangkok. Steve, it's good to have you with us. Your understanding of the situation, of course, the 60 million barrels, how much of a lasting effect do you think it's going to have on the market, or perhaps impede it from going any further? And, of course, the impact that it's had on the markets already.
Well, I mean, Russia is, you know, a major oil supplier, and certainly a very major oil supplier to Europe. And, of course, gas is again a dramatic component of their exports. So there's no easy, there's a relatively easy way around oil in some sense, but of course that drives the price much higher, and you have to import from Saudi Arabia rather than Russia, largely. But gas is a very different story. There's no real easy way to suddenly replace the loss of the gas supplies if that actually was taken that far. So we have a dramatic drop in immediate needs for manufacturing. And this is why Russia has the upper hand in this particular struggle, because what Russia exports is needed immediately, or production either shuts down or prices have to rise dramatically and ration output that way. Whereas what Russia needs, things like silicon chips from Taiwan and so on, will have a delayed effect upon their economy. So they've got a very strong bargaining tool here, and for that reason the sanctions are nowhere near as effective as they would be if we were actually, you know, cutting oil off to Russia rather than vice versa.
All right. Steve, how about the effect that this releasing of the reserves by the U.S. has had on the market? You know, maybe in the in the short run, maybe it's going to stabilize the market. Well, you tell me. But do you think, you know, is it going to have a lasting effect and, you know, stabilize the markets the way they should?
How long?
Yeah. I mean, how much of a reserve is there, you know, to basically stabilize the market in the long run?
Well, there's none. I mean, oil is stored to some extent. There are buffers of it around the planet, but nothing like the level of even monthly consumption. So if we have a reduction in the supply and you try to use the existing stocks to make up for that reduction of supply, you might have 2 weeks, but then you're going to find that stock has run out and then you're reliant upon the actual output. It's possible to ramp up production in that time, but you're going to get a higher price out of it. So in that sense, pardon the pun, but Putin does have the West over a barrel over this one.
So in a way, some kind of a political solution has to be reached, you're saying, in order to basically bring the markets, or, you know, keep the markets under control. And, you know, the issue of those stocks, I think, you know, that follows the same scenario. Isn't that right, Steve?
Yeah, the stock market's going to be disturbed because, I mean, in some ways, oil producers will do well out of this because the price is going to go through the roof. And that applies to Russia as well, where Russia still manages to get sales. So it's not an effective, in that sense, if you wanted to control, you're far better off controlling the energy input than you are controlling the supply of manufactured goods. And that gives Russia the power in this negotiation.
I know we're not talking politics here, Steve, but, you know, given the power of economy and the power of money, do you think what is basically the tolerance of the markets? What's the tolerance of the oil market to become a leverage in order to perhaps, you know, bring the two sides to the negotiating table and put an end to this?
There's a reasonable chance of that. I mean, what it's teaching us is, and we keep on learning this lesson and keep on forgetting it, how dependent we are upon energy. Nothing could just produce without energy. And that's left out of how economists think, unfortunately. So every time we get an energy crisis, they end up being surprised by it. But fundamentally, because over 80% of our energy needs come from fossil fuels, in any political struggle, that gives the fossil fuel producers the upper hand. So the oil market, I think, will actually probably be arguing, trying to actually restrain the extent to which the West imposes these controls on Russia. The only thing that works in the opposite direction, of course, is that the oil producers themselves aren't exactly friendly. So this is advantageous to the Saudi Arabian, to the Arabian production of oil, rather than Russian and American. So I can't see any coherent force coming out of the oil industry in general to try to make this be resolved. I think you've got to come down to the impact on Russians themselves making the war unpopular, and therefore persuading Putin to accept potentially concessions on how far NATO has encroached towards their borders in return for a honourable retreat. But I think that's about the only hope we have.
Steve Keen, economist and author in Bangkok, Thailand. Many, many thanks.
Welcome.
First, Ukrainian refugees have started arriving in Italy after Russia launched a military operation in Ukraine last week. Meanwhile, African refugees have been pushed back and trying to cross the border with Poland.
The first refugees fleeing from conflict-stricken Ukraine have arrived in northern Italy as Europe braces, the media are saying, for a major humanitarian crisis. So far, arriving refugees, who mostly comprise women, children and the elderly, have been registered in four Italian regions, namely Trentino, Veneto, Emilia-Romagna and Friuli-Venezia Giulia. In addition, scores of African-born expats have joined hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to escape Ukraine and cross into Poland and other neighboring countries. Reports have emerged suggesting that many black refugees have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
Africans are being stopped from leaving Ukraine because of the color of their skin. It is shocking. It brings us back to the dark age of racism and intolerance against black people. I'm disgusted. Also because the media here in Italy do not cover these stories as they should.
Nigeria and South Africa have denounced such discrimination, calling on border officials in Ukraine and its neighbors to treat their nationals equally.
About 30,000 Africans, mostly from Nigeria, Morocco and Egypt, reside in Ukraine. They make up more than 20% of Ukraine's international students, attracted by the country's good technical and medical schools, combined with relatively low fees.
It is a basic principle in international refugee law, as well as in all human rights law, the principle of non-discrimination, a basic principle which has to be observed by all states, also here, certainly by Poland, Ukraine and the other countries around Ukraine.
The Italian government has recently agreed to redistribute Ukrainian refugees across the European Union. Italy will likely receive 13% of the total allocation. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Mario Draghi said, while reporting to the Senate on the Ukraine crisis, that, quote, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a decisive turning point in European history. Max Civili, Rome.
That's my time for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate Thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for Thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to Thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
In the United States, police officers fear retaliation if they step in to stop misconduct by other police officers. In the wake of George Floyd's death, police departments are trying to change that. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Shayla Dewan. The piece is titled, A New Message for Police. If you see something, say something. On an early Monday morning in a chilly classroom in Baltimore, Maryland, a diverse group of recruits to one of the nation's most troubled police departments gathered for a new kind of training. the screen flashed a photo of a man whose face is now familiar to the world. "What happened to George Floyd?" the instructor barked. "He was lynched," one trainee responded. "He was murdered," another trainee said. "How many other police officers were there?" the instructor asked. Many knew the answer. 3. That was the crux of the matter at hand. Not the senior officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck, Derek Chauvin, but the 3 others who did not stop him. The question of what other police officers could or should have done was not abstract. More than 1,000 miles away, those same 3 former police officers, 2 of them ranked rookies, were standing trial on charges that they failed to prevent the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May of 2020. On Thursday, they were convicted and could face many years in prison. For decades, many police critics have complained that police officers who allow police misconduct to happen do more damage to the community's trust than the police officers who commit it. Yet, they have not been a focus. When Rodney King was tased and beaten by 4 Los Angeles police officers in 1991, more than 12 other police officers looked on. None of the onlookers faced charges. The federal trial of 2 Tao, J. Alexander Kung, and Thomas Lane in Minnesota this month was one of the rare attempts to hold police officers to account over the issue. The duty to stop a fellow police officer who is engaging in misconduct has long been embedded in many department policies and upheld by the courts of law. But the defendants in Minnesota argued that during their training, it was little more than a word on a PowerPoint. Police officers across the United States have been told they must intervene if they see a fellow police officer behave in misconduct, but they have not necessarily been taught how to do so. George Floyd's death has begun to change that. More than 215 police departments have signed up for a Georgetown University program that teaches police officers the philosophy and techniques of intervention. Watching the Floyd video, you're thinking the only thing that could have snapped any one of those police officers out of it would have been for another one of them to intervene, said Chief Kelly McCarthy of Mendota Heights, a Minneapolis suburb, whose department has begun to use the training. Dallas, Seattle, Los Angeles, Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and all of New Jersey are also participating. Active bystander training is not new. The airline industry and hospitals have used it to empower co-pilots and nurses to speak up to prevent mistakes. And it has even been used to help stop sexual assault on college campuses. Its use in policing began in New Orleans in 2016, after a number of police officers faced criminal charges, including a rookie who went to prison for helping cover up a fatal beating perpetrated by his training officer. But other police departments have been slow to adopt such programs for many reasons. The paramilitary structure of law enforcement agencies discourages questioning the chain of command, and departments have a long track record of retaliating against whistleblowers. Police officers who break the culture of silence risk being passed over for promotions or even being fired themselves, as Carol Horn in Buffalo, New York, was after she stopped a white police officer from choking a black subject. To overcome these barriers, trainees are told that program is not about ratting about their comrades, but stopping them from committing misconduct in the first place. They are told to think of police officers in need of intervention as humans who get tired and stressed and make mistakes, and of themselves as helpers who can respond to warning signs of mental illness, addiction, or suicide. Intervention, the premise goes, is just one more way that police officers take care of one another. We get an opportunity to redefine this whole freaking thing about the thin blue line, redefine what it means to have each other's back, said Jerry Clayton, the sheriff in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's so hypocritical to criticize the community around no snitching, an unwritten rule on the street that police officers say prevents them from solving crimes. And then we turn around and say, I can talk about that thing that happened. Michael Harrison was the chief who started the training in New Orleans in 2015 with the help of Irvin Staub, a psychologist and Holocaust survivor who has studied the dynamics of bystander intervention. Michael Harrison brought the program with him to Baltimore, Maryland, where he's now the commissioner. At both police departments, he has been charged with correcting a pattern of constitutional violations under agreements with the Justice Department known as consent decrees. Historically, loyalty was looked at as, if I confide in you, you keep my secret, Commissioner Harrison said. We started teaching loyalty should be displayed on the front end to prevent potential injury, death, career ruin, or even worse. The bottom line, he said, let me help you not make this mistake in the first place. In the 2 years after New Orleans trained its police officers, the number of canine bites, police shootings, vehicle chases, and use of force complaints dropped. Because of other changes mandated by the consent decree, it is not clear how much of those declines are attributable to intervention training. But close observers like Jonathan Aroney, the federal monitor, say it helped change department culture. In Baltimore this month, the trainees acted out scenarios that might call for intervention. In one police officer begins an illegal search of a woman's car. In another, a supervisor pressures a police officer to pretend he did not hear a suspect ask for a lawyer, a request that normally would put an end to an interrogation.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Egypt's prisons.
It's not strange for Israel, nor America, nor some European nations that are colonialist to enlist some of the Palestinian resistance factions on their terrorist organizations' lists. But it is very strange for some Arab countries to join these nations' efforts that are aimed at eliminating the Palestinian resistance by all means.
Thank President Hosni Mubarak for his leadership and his understanding of the situation, and also to thank the President of the United States, George W. Bush, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, for their endless efforts throughout the last 3 weeks in order to protect the right of Israel for self-defense against terrorist activities, and at the same time to help create the necessary international environment that will bring an end to hostilities while guaranteeing the right of Israel to defend itself against any aggression perpetrated by terrorist organizations from whichever direction.
Olmert's gratitude to Mubarak was not a result of nothing, but it was due to something. It was due to something between them, something that can be uncovered to us by Hossam Washah from Al-Baraj refugee camp in central Gaza. This 27-year-old youth was arrested by the Egyptian authorities, then transferred to one of the interrogation centers in the town of Al-Arish.
I was arrested along with an elderly man who's still in jail in Egypt. I was taken to Al-Arish and then to Al-Yadhiqli in Cairo. I was held by the National Security Forces. I received horrible treatment, interrogation, torture, and humiliation from the Egyptian National Security and Intelligence Services.
Ayman Nofel, 35, entered Egypt in the beginning of 2008 when thousands of Palestinians opened holes in the security fence between Gaza and Egypt, seeking to get urgent necessities lacking due to the shocking siege.
I was arrested on the 27th of January 2008 on my way to Al-Arish. I entered like everyone else. I was looking to buy necessities. It was during the days when the fence between Gaza and Egypt was penetrated. I was arrested inside Al-Arish city. The police pulled me over and found handguns with the other two guys in the same car. So we were transferred to Sector 4, and an hour later I was handed over to the National Security Agency.
Ramzi Al-Rai, a young man from Rafah, south of Gaza, was injured by an Israeli bullet and a tank shell fragment in 2004. He continued to suffer from the injury until 2010, when the Egyptian authorities allowed him to enter Egypt for treatment.
I got in around March 2010. I was injured during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. I had tank shell shrapnel in my body. I managed to get a permit for medical treatment in Egypt because I'd been advised to get shrapnel fragments removed, and that treatment was safer and better in Egypt. I booked a room at a hotel after arriving. After about 15 minutes, my room was raided. They threw me to the floor, handcuffed me, and began searching me and the room. I told them, "Why are you searching me? I have nothing. I'm here to get treatment." They said it was a security procedure. Then they took me outside and told me they would need me for only 5 minutes.
Mohammed Al-Hashim lives in northern Gaza. After the end of the war on Gaza in 2009, he and some of his friends decided to go perform the Umrah in Mecca through crossing Egyptian territories.
After living under siege for a long time, we really miss traveling abroad. So we registered for Umrah along with hundreds of others. Just like anyone else, we wanted to perform the Umrah in Saudi Arabia. We were a group included several that had injuries from war on Gaza. We went to Syria, where some got treatment and some others went to Iran for same purpose. We spent 11 months abroad, awaiting permission to return home, but to no avail. We tried Egypt Air, but they rejected us. So we decided to fly Saudi Air. When we got off the plane in Cairo, they arrested us as soon as they saw our passports. Then they took us to the National Security Center.
The ceremony of this reception in Egypt went as follows.
I did not expect a strip search. After they strip searched me, I put my clothes back on. Then they brought me bread and cheese. I told them I wasn't hungry. The officer left the room. I thought he was going to bring a supervisor, but suddenly I felt a strong stinging sensation all over my body. They were electrocuting me. They used it on my head, back, and side. They said, "We told you, you will eat. Anyone who refused to eat got electrocuted."
As for Hassan Washah, his reception in the interrogation and torture center included insults, beatings, and other torture methods.
The intelligence services handed me to the National Security Agency. I'd already been tortured by the intelligence agents, but they did it to me again at the National Security Agency. For days, I was beaten, tortured, and humiliated.
Nofal was not one of the lucky Qassam fighters' leaders in the treatment he got, despite the fact that the Egyptian security forces were aware that he is a leader in the Palestinian resistance and is wanted by the Israeli occupation.
They used beatings, fists, blindfolding, handcuffing, humiliation, and insults. They would threaten me, saying, "If you don't confess, we will undress you and give you an electric shock." They didn't, but I wish they would, because it would have been easier to tolerate than watching all those young men get electrocuted.
After 3 days, they began serious interrogation with me, which meant being stripped naked, tied to a metal bed, tied at the feet, with the legs separated apart so that, as you can imagine, they would be able to electrocute me anywhere they could, like on the ears, tongue, and privates. They would rub a diesel fuel-soaked cloth on the body, which caused burn marks on the skin when electrocuted. It felt like your skin was on fire. Those torture sessions would last 1 or 2 hours.
The torture of Palestinian resistors behind the wall of Egypt's national security centers condemns Mubarak's former regime and proves it was connected to foreign intelligence services.
The arrest had definitely been ordered by Israel because of all the questions they would ask. What is the structure of resistance? What kind of preparations have they made? How far can the rockets go? What kind of explosives and weapons do they possess? All those questions had something to do with Israel and didn't mean to harm Egypt in any way. The interrogator once told me, "In 2004, you were part of a resistance mission in Israel." I answered, "If I did something to the Jews, then why am I in prison in Egypt? You should thank me." The officer answered, "My son, if we, in national security, could, we would burn Gaza."
It's not natural. You would feel that he is a Jew, like an Israeli interrogating you. Due to his intensive concern about Israel's security, you would feel that he is not a Muslim nor Arab. He does not have even the slightest bit of the Arab race in him. His questions include, did the Jews harm? All this that you see on TV, and he is asking me if the Jews harmed me? Did they personally harm you? I answered him, "Do they have to enter our house and kill my brother?" So he asked again, "So did they kill your brother or father, or torture you, or imprison you or your father?" I answered him, "So it has to come on my head. They occupied and stole my land, and murdered my people, and killed and disfigured us. And you are asking me if they harmed me?"
According to Muhammad al-Hashim, torture methods were numerous and had a purpose. He never expected himself to face terror charges in an Arab country because he is a resistor of the Israeli occupation.
We felt that those in national security and Egyptian security forces were looking for something. They always tried to get as much information as they could to serve Israel and America. For 30 years, that regime supported and protected Israel at the expense of humiliating Palestinians. It made them feel lost and worthless. The Americans paid the Egyptians $20 a day to keep in jail anyone who tried to harm Israel. Anyone, an alleged jihadist or a resistance fighter.
It was like the Israeli agents' interrogation style. While I was there, I felt like I was sitting in the interrogation rooms inside the Al-Magdal prison in Israel. They wanted information, and all their questions were focused on the resistance weapons, the structure of the Al-Qassam brigades, the range of missiles they had, and how Shalit was kidnapped and kept in captivity. Let's say all this was during the first month. After that, I was kept as a hostage to blackmail Hamas.
When torturing Palestinian resistors does not bring any results, they are thrown in Egypt's prisons in an attempt to make them hopeless so that they might give out information that can help the Egyptian security forces aid the Israeli occupation.
For 24 months, I was alone and isolated in Al-Marq prison in the district of Al-Golubiya next to Cairo. As a human being, I was concerned about the information I had and how I could withhold it, especially information about the resistance weapons and the Shalit issue. Speaking about these issues is very difficult. It's better to die a martyr than whisper about these issues. I thought of two scenarios on how to get released. Either Mubarak dies or Shalit is released. We had strong faith in God. The Egyptian revolution succeeded after Mubarak was removed. We hoped that after this toppling, we would be released from prison.
Ayman was detained in the corridors of Egypt's prisons along with 10 members of Al-Qassam fighters as part of a scheme to blackmail the Hamas movement. As for Muhammad al-Hashim, he was released after a 10-month journey of torture.
The Islamic Jihad leadership received the message saying their prisoners had been released. The situation in Egypt was very dangerous, so they moved us quickly. In July 2010, we were moved from Al-Kanater prison directly to the Rafah border crossing, and from there to the Palestinian side of the border. Thank God.
After a long suffering, Muhammad al-Hashim arrived in Gaza. As for Hassan Washah, he was transferred from Al-Arish prison to Abu Zabal prison in Cairo.
Abu Zabal prison is known around the world. I never thought that one day I'd be held in there. It's a well-guarded prison. I was in my cell 24 hours a day and not allowed to go out. I was placed with criminals convicted of stealing, murder, and selling drugs. Even though you are a political prisoner, they surround you with criminals to humiliate you.
Hassan might spend years, or even his entire life, in one of the worst prisons in Egypt with criminal convicts. As for Ramzi, the Egyptian interrogators are still making him taste the worst types of torture.
Suddenly he said to me, "Look, I will give you something you never saw before. Today I will break you. I pleaded, please have mercy. I will tell you whatever you want to hear. Look, so far I have managed to stand all the torture, including electrocution." At this stage, I told him, just get me a nice piece of paper and I will write all they wanted to know and sign it. He was surprised and told me to sit down. I started to sit, but I felt something was underneath me. Then someone hit me in the head and I plunged down. I suddenly felt a burning electrical current run through my body. I was being electrocuted from the inside. It was nothing like the other type of electrocution. I cannot even begin to describe the pain. Honestly, it's inexplicable. The next day he asked me, "Are you mocking me? You say you will talk when things get serious, but then you don't." I said, "I wanted to tell you to please have mercy on me." Once again, he sat me on the electric chair like it wasn't enough to get electrocuted through the rectum once. When they transferred me to Abu Zab prison, I felt like a ball of blood with long hair and nails. My fellow brethren were shocked. They cleaned me up. My journey of suffering and ill treatment came to an end.
Ramzi's goal in Egypt was to get treatment for the wounds he had sustained at the hands of the Israeli occupation army. But the interrogation and torture he received in Egypt added to his wounds in ways he never imagined.
We hope that the Egyptian army would take a serious humanitarian look at the circumstances and case of Ramzi Arai, because his health is in a very bad situation, and he has never been proven to be criminal, nor have done anything bad to Egypt.
After the passing of 1 year for Ramzi in Egyptian prisons, and 3.5 years for Ayman and Hassan Washa, the promise of the January 25th revolution began to loom in the horizon, which reignited hope for the tens of millions that awaited for it for too many years. This Arabian revolution came to change an abusive, merciless regime that inflicted on Egyptian and those around them the worst types of torture, a regime that turned Egypt from the beating heart of the Arab and Islamic world to an economically, politically, and socially poor nation.
We heard gunfire in the afternoon of the 29th. They closed up Abu Zab prison. We felt there is something going on. The TV showed there was trouble outside. There was regular gunfire. The prisoners began breaking the doors and heading for freedom. Some were killed or injured. The prisoners' families helped us. And along the way, we didn't encounter one single roadblock.
On Saturday, we heard that Abu Zab prisoners had gotten out. At 8 a.m. Sunday, January 30th, we broke down the doors and got out of prison. We walked near family homes where we met a nice-looking man. We explained to him we were Palestinian resistance fighters who had been imprisoned by the evil Mubarak regime. The man sympathized with us and let us use his phone. He also helped us get a car. We stayed at his house and moved from house to house until we reached Gaza.
Around the beginning of the Egyptian Revolution on January 29th, Hassan arrived in Gaza as the first Palestinian liberated from Egyptian prisons. And 3 days after him, Nofal arrived home to his family. As for the family of Ramzi Arai, they were the last to meet him. Luckily, for them, time passed quickly.
We were waiting for his return, so my sons went to receive him, and they were quite ready to receive their father, but there was no destiny yet. Of course, he was in the prison like all other prisoners. They were surprised of the groups of people raiding the prison, breaking the walls and doors, liberating the prisoners. He was also liberated.
The doors of prison opened and armed men entered. They clashed with the government forces inside. And before we knew it, we were on the streets not knowing where to go until a car took us to the Ismailia area. And from there, we headed to Al-Arish. As luck would have it, we were captured by the army. We thought it was going to be prison and torture again. They asked us what we were doing there. Then they transferred us by military planes to Al-Aqraba prison.
Ramzi did not have to stay in prison for too long, because after the collapse of the Mubarak regime, he was released and returned home to reunite with his family.
I was in jail for exactly 10 days. I had a release order, so I was released. I was very happy to be free. It felt like a dream to be out and on the way home. When I arrived in Palestine, I could not believe my eyes. I knelt down and kissed the ground. Then I met my friends, my family, and my mother. I felt like I had been born again.
In the limelight.
Telecommunications giant Ericsson's internal investigators uncovered charges it was involved in corruption in at least 10 countries. We now present you an article written jointly by Rob Evans and Michael Safi. The piece is titled Revealed: Leaked Files Show How Ericsson Helped Bribe Daesh Terrorists. Confidential documents have revealed how the telecommunications giant Ericsson is charged to have helped pay bribes to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in order to continue selling its services after the terrorists seized control of large parts of Iraq. The leak of internal investigations at Ericsson, which also found that the firm had put its contractors at risk and allowed them to be kidnapped by the terrorists, is potentially damaging for the multinational. In addition to the findings about the payments to Daesh terrorists, the investigations uncovered charges the company was involved in corruption in at least 10 countries across four continents. That would suggest a pattern of wrongdoing by Ericsson that is far wider than what the telecommunications giant publicly admitted in 2019, when it entered into a $1 billion settlement with the US Department of Justice. Ericsson, which is headquartered in Stockholm, Sweden, employs 100,000 people and sells telecommunications equipment in 180 countries. It plays a leading role in developing the next generation of 5G mobile phone technology in the United Kingdom. Recently, Ericsson's stock price plunged by 14% when, alerted to the fact that media organizations had been leaked the internal reports, it released a public statement admitting to serious breaches of compliance rules in Iraq between 2011 and 2019. Since then, the telecommunications firm has been bracing itself for the full disclosure of the reports, which were leaked to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which then shared them with media partners, including the BBC, The Washington Post, and The Guardian. The leaked documents, running to 101 pages, were produced in 2019 and 2020. they record the results of internal investigations commissioned by Ericsson into the corruption by the company around the world. Investigators concluded that the multinational firm was likely to have been involved in channeling bribes to Daesh terrorists to allow its products to be transported across parts of Iraq that were held by the extremists. According to the investigators, the payments were made through a slush fund run by contractors working for the Swedish multinational. After recent questions from journalists about the leaked documents, Ericsson appears to have sought to get ahead of a public relations crisis by publishing the statement on its website, partially admitting to the investigators' findings. In the statement, Ericsson admitted the investigating team had identified payments to intermediaries and the use of alternate transport routes in connection with circumventing Iraqi customs, at a time when terrorist organizations, including Daesh terrorists, controlled some transport routes. It claimed investigators could not determine the ultimate recipients of these payments. Payment schemes and cash transactions that potentially created the risk of money laundering were also identified. The statement also conceded Ericsson employees had engaged in widespread misconduct in Iraq and committed serious violations of its regulations, including irregular payments and non-payment of tax between 2011 and 2019. Ericsson claimed it had published a statement because it was committed to transparency.